I took a stroll into the general office to meet Reg Gould, and Dennis O'Connell's assessment was absolutely right. I don't know what cesspool that character was dragged out of. He was a thick-set, middle-aged man. The thing about it, there's a couple of characteristics about him that struck me immediately, that when he smiled, his eyes never smiled. The smile was on his lips, and the eyes were cold, and they remained cold. The smile was the smile of a sadist. It was the sort of smile you would expect to find on the person who enjoyed pulling the wings off flies. Psychologically, I was revulsed by his presence, that I was in the presence of something dreadfully evil and something very nasty. And when she met him a couple of days later, she took time off to go up there. She was even more revulsed than me. She said she nearly threw up. She couldn't stand being in the presence of the man. He completely revulsed. Complete revulsion was Anne's response to him. She was even more sensitive to it than I was. Anyway, that was the state. That was the isness of the situation, as one would say, and there was nothing really any of us could do about it. I do know that there were some very stiff letters written by Dennis O'Connell and Stan Rich and so forth to the old man, just on their giving their displeasure at this type of person that had been put in charge of them in the organisation, pointing out to Ron that they felt no loyalty to Reg Gould. The only loyalty they felt was to Ron Hubbard. But again, they only got any half-hearted responses back from Ron, thanking them for their loyalty and so on. There was no suggestion that Reg Gould was going to go. Reg Gould was obviously there to stay. Well, that put Anne and I out of the org and put me out of the centre of the proceedings for a while. Anne was really pleased, actually, to get away and have a break. The girl had been working herself into the ground. And it was wonderful to see her come back up tone scale, see the tension slough off her as she relaxed at home and started to pick up her auditing practice. We weren't short of free clears. Many of the people I'd worked with had known Anne, known the Battersea number. And anyway, any old pre-clear who I'd audited through the org, they only had to phone the org and ask for the Dennis Stevens' telephone number, and they would have got the Battersea number. Many of them did. In those days, we did have the open comm line system. It's something almost unheard of these days, that you could phone up Hasley and get the telephone number of a field auditor. But in those days, you could. You could phone up Hasley and get the telephone number of any field auditor you asked for. So Anne and I settled down to a quiet domesticity of auditing, of full-time field auditors, and it was a beautiful, beautiful life. Quiet and plenty of work, as much work as we chose to do, and we would take time off in the summer and went down and had a holiday, and it was a beautiful period of time that was, and the children were amazed. It was lovely. They were overjoyed to have both of us around so much. So it really did benefit both of us having that break. Meanwhile, a clinic was obtained, but it was not got by, although Reg Gould was supposed to have gone out and got part of his job was to go and get a clinic, he never did. The clinic was finally obtained by George Wishlow. I got that from Dennis O'Connell. And it was the efforts of George Wishlow that finally got a clinic. We got premises at 83 Palace Gardens Terrace, which was on the corner of Bayswater Road and Palace Gardens Terrace, only about a stone's throw from Notting Hill Gate Station, right in the middle of Notting Hill Gate Shopping Centre. It couldn't have been better placed. It was a beautiful spot, right next door to the new Lindsay Theatre, where Ron subsequently used for public lectures. And it was a marvellous choice on George's part. And it was quickly agreed by the old man in America, and the deed was signed. And then his V staff came in and started shifting furniture into the place. And by the time Anne and I have got up there and heard about it and got in there, it was already got chairs and so forth in there, and it was looking forward to opening up business. The next thing we knew, summer of 1953, just as quickly as he'd appeared on the scene, Reg Gould disappeared off the scene. Just overnight, he vanished. This time there was nobody knew what had happened, until on one Monday morning, a lady named Jean Atkinson walked in and said that she was the new administrator and had a letter in her pocket from Ron Hubbard, giving her full authority to take over the administration position at HASI. And this set everything buzzing again. Reg Gould had disappeared as quickly as he'd appeared. He must have said or done something that had offended Ron and been summarily fired. And this new woman had come in. Again, we didn't know where she came from. Nobody knew her. Again, she wasn't even a book auditor. She hadn't read anything. She knew nothing of Dianetics and Scientology. Oh, she'd heard of it, but she'd never studied it at all, as far as we could gather. And there was she being put in charge of the administration of the place. And she was a woman of about 40, 45. I'm not a person to be critical, but she didn't look the best. She was dressed rather shabbily, and her fingers were nicotine stained. She was a chain smoker, and she wasn't. Well, probably her biggest failing was that I always thought that she could have bathed more often. That it wasn't exactly pleasant getting downwind from the lady, and. But that could have been some physiological difficulty she had. But anyway, it didn't help her at all socially. And anyway, she seemed efficient at her job. She spoke in a rather tyrannical manner, and one felt that she was no doubt an administrator. She reminded me of something you might find in the matron of a Victorian hospital. You know, that was the first impression I had of the woman. But she seemed a better personality than Reg Gould. There was nothing slimy about her. There was nothing like that sliminess one felt when one was talking to Gould. It was just unfortunate that she knew nothing of the subject. Of course, now it was a few months since we'd left the organisation, and there have been quite a fair number of students had gone through and trained, and. The clinic was going to be opened up, and a guy called Fred Welling was going to take charge of the clinic, and he was a recent graduate, HPA graduate. I didn't know him, I'd never met him. He'd arrived on the scene, done the day course after I'd left the scene, so I'd never audited him and knew nothing of him. He was to start off the clinic, and I went up to the Palace Gardens Terrace one day, and he had a couple of staff auditors there. There was no auditing going on there, but evidently him and the two staff auditors were on the payroll. The big lecture room there had been more or less furnished with plenty of chairs, but there was no lecturing going on. The PE was still going on down in 163 Holland Park Avenue. He had the whole of this clinic all to himself at that moment, at that time, and there didn't seem to be any auditing going on. And that seemed to be the situation in the summer of 1953. And out of the blue, Nibs Hubbard turned up in London, sent over by his old way father, sent over by Ron, to give a Bachelor of Scientology course to all those who were willing to take it. And Nibs at that time was about 18 and a half years of age. He was Ron's eldest son from his first marriage. And he was a very, very big lad with Nibs. He would have turned the scales at about 230 pounds. And he was built like a soft armoured tank with Nibs. His features didn't resemble Ron's very much, but he had the flaming hair of the Hubbard family. There was no doubt he was Ron's son. And he brought his new wife with him. She was about 19. She was about 6 months older than he was, but she was a roly-poly, jolly girl. And the two of them together would probably have weighed the scales down at over 500 pounds, I would have said, the two of them together. I liked his wife. She was a very nice, jolly girl. I wasn't all that much impressed by Nibs. He seemed very, very tense all the time. He seemed a young man who couldn't relax. And it wasn't until much later that I realised what was happening, why he was endlessly so tense. Anyway, the Nibs started to started to organise the course, get the course underway. Anne and I decided not to have anything to do with it. We were far too busy, and there didn't seem to be all that much point in it. And neither of us were particularly impressed by Nibs. We thought, well, Ron will be back soon, and we knew he'd been giving courses in the USA, Ron had, and we thought, well. And then Dennis O'Connell got on the phone one evening. He said, look, don't start on that course. He said, I'm still looking after the training here, he says, and Nibs has got his tapes over. He's got came in, brought his tapes in, and he's keeping all his tapes in the same drawer, same cupboard where we keep all the HPA tapes. He said, as soon as he's finished using them, he said, we'll all hear those tapes. He said, so don't bother to go and take the course. And Dennis was as good as his word. George Wishlow never bothered. Stan Richard never bothered. We simply spent a quiet time when Nibs has finished with the tapes. Well, and in the evenings he wasn't using the tapes. We were over in Dennis O'Connell's place with the tapes, listening to the tapes. Nibs never did find out. He never knew anything that happened. I mean, Dennis had a key to the cupboard. Nibs put the finished with the tape for the day, put them in the cupboard, locked the cupboard up. Dennis had his own key to the cupboard, took tapes out of the cupboard, took them home, and we were all turning up. George Wishlow, Stan Richards, Anne and I, we all turned up with the tapes. We kept it in that select crew. There's nobody else allowed, just us. We heard all these BSCN material tapes, so none of us lost anything on the deal. We all heard the tape one way or the other. Nibs at Nibs Hubbard, they called him Nibs. It was meant L. Ron Hubbard Jr. He was an L. He had the same Christian names as his dad, and apparently in America, anyone with the same Christian names as their father, they could call them Nibs. And Nibs Hubbard was. He'd had a fair whack of auditing from Ron, and we found out later that his case was he was a good theatre clear, a very good theatre exterior was Nibs Hubbard. But we did find out why this tenseness there that he was living under. What had happened was evidently that Ron had audited him very thoroughly and was then started to shovel the responsibility on his shoulders, started to pile up, and Ron was expecting Nibs to be his successor. And so he was piling this responsibility on him, and Nibs, this was his fledgling flight, was to go to London and give a BSCN course alone, solo. And Nibs didn't want to do it. He simply really hadn't got the ability. The people who were on the course, one or two of the old-timers went on the course and said that as an instructor he was a complete flop. Half the time he wasn't in the room, and he couldn't really face up to an audience, and he didn't answer the questions properly. And half the time his attention seemed to be elsewhere. I mean, he simply wasn't interested to do the job. And so it was no surprise that the course was a complete flop. It was a complete washout. That it was one of those courses that was best forgotten. All those who did the course eventually did get a BSCN course out of it. But it was probably the worst course ever given in London. Of that type, but this explained the tension, and Nibs was building up more and more tension. And in later years, of course, Nibs's name became very bad in Scientology because he blew the org and so forth. And Ron said some very nasty things about his son. And really, it was the old man's fault. He was piling too much responsibility on this lad, and all that was happening was that Nibs felt that he was overting because he couldn't live up to his father's expectations of him. He was simply overting all the time against his father, and overting against Scientology, and this was making him tense. And he was simply overting all the time because he couldn't live up to the expectations that his father was expecting of him. That, of course, was an overt act in his mind. This was the trouble with Nibs. Anyway, after the BSCN course was over, Nibs gave a congress. That was a part of his agreement with his dad, that he'd run this congress, which he ran. Anne and I attended the congress, and he ran that very badly. He did little else but turn the tape machines on and turn them off again and say hello and goodbye. And we hardly ever saw him at the Congress. The whole thing was just sitting listening to a tape recorder. There was little presentation, and no work had been done much on the Congress. The staff, Dennis Oakley O'Connell and Stan Richards, were doing their best to keep the public going, but the leader, Nibbs, was not present, you know. And so, of course, the leader not being present, it was falling apart. And it was a most unsatisfactory Congress. And it culminated with a dance at the end in the hotel, and when Nibbs got into the bar, and this is unbelievable, but there's a guy called Jack Parkhouse on the HPA course at the time. He was on the weekend course, and he was one of the students on the course, and he got up talking to Nibbs. They apparently struck a chord together, and they got drinking whiskey, and they got into a ridiculous drinking competition, and Nibbs was just in the frame of mind to let off steam. And he just challenged Jack Parkhouse to see who could drink the most whiskey. Well, it was quite obvious who could drink the most whiskey. Nibbs could, because he was almost twice as big as Jack Parkhouse. So Jack Parkhouse ended up at 10:30 at night under the table, passed out cold. And Nibbs Hubbard couldn't wind up to say good night to everyone at the end of the dance, because he couldn't stand. And Anne and I ended up helping him in a taxi, and his wife was hovering nearby. We finally got this 230 pounds of drunken Nibbs into a taxi, and headed off to the hotel where he was living. And it was there that we found out, we couldn't get him on the seat of the cab because he was too heavy, and he was a dead weight. He couldn't stand, he was absolutely plastered. And we finally, he was calling out the cab. He was on the floor of the cab, and he was exteriorised. He got his eyes closed, and he was calling out the colours of the traffic lights in front of us as we were going along in the cab. And he was correct. He never made one mistake. He said, next set of traffic lights is red, and this next set of traffic lights, just round the corner, is a set of traffic lights. We go around the corner, there's the set of traffic lights. He said, the next set of traffic lights is just going to green now. And the traffic lights would go to green now. He had very good present-time theatre perception. So Ron had done a first-class job of exteriorising his son. Case-wise, he must have been in pretty good case, pretty good condition. There was nothing wrong with him case-wise, Nibbs Hubbard, because he couldn't have had that acute theatre perception that he had. But he just had too much responsibility on his shoulders. He was only 18 and a half years of age. If he'd have been 5 years older, he could have held the responsibility and done a better job. Or maybe if he'd have been 5 years older, he simply would have refused his dad and said, I'm not interested. He wouldn't have been there anyway. But a lot of people in the general public saw Nibbs in that disgusting drunken state, and he saw him being helped into the cab and so forth. And it didn't do Scientology a bit of good. It didn't do the org a bit of good, having Nibbs Hubbard being carried into a cab lying drunk and unable to perform his official functions at the Congress. Jack Parkhouse later on became quite a well-known figure in Scientology about a year or two later. He was a brilliant student. He was one of the best students that ever came out of Hassie London HPA, of the HPA course. He was good, Jack Parkhouse, very good. He was a good administrator and a fine technical mind. Anyway, that was the last we saw of Nibbs, and I never saw Nibbs again after that. That day, the following day or 2 days later, him and his wife got back in their aeroplane and went back to the USA, and that was the end of Nibbs. We did hear afterwards that people had made quite sure that Ron knew of this drunken debacle at the Congress, and apparently he was absolutely furious with his son, absolutely furious, understandably so. Well, things were jogging along there. We, of course, were still down in Battersea doing our auditing. All that seemed to be changing in the org was that Gene Atkinson was getting more and more people in our staff. The admin staff was growing out of all bounds. The tech staff wasn't growing. There was no more pre-clears in the clinic. The clinic seemed to be doing atrocious business. And we knew that there was trouble fermenting down there. we knew that there was no love lost between Dennis O'Connell and Gene Atkinson, or between Fred Welling and Gene Atkinson, came to that. And eventually it came to a head, and Dennis O'Connell and Fred Welling wrote to Ron and said that this woman's got to go. They can't work with her, she's a tyrant. And so they said either she goes or they go. Well, Ron, of course, there was nothing else he could do but accept their resignations. So Dennis O'Connell and Fred Welling both left the organisation. The loss of Fred Welling was no loss to the organisation, because he was, he simply wasn't capable of doing the work he was put there to do in the clinic. He simply wasn't technically good enough. But more of Fred Welling in a moment. But the loss of Dennis O'Connell was a severe blow. He was, at that time, he was no doubt London's best trainer. He was good. He'd been at the job for the longest, and he was the best trainer there. Although he wasn't really, I'd much rather be auditing than teaching. But he was getting good, and that was a blow. So Stan Richards had to move in. Stan Richards left the evening course and weekend course, and he moved in on the day course, which he didn't want to do because he was doing a fair bit of auditing during the day. And it upset his scheduling. And they got a new guy called Ron Jeffcott, came in. He was he graduated some time previously, and he took over the weekend and evening HPA courses, what Stan Richards had been doing. And he was pretty on the ball, was Jeffcott, but he was moonlighting. He had a full-time day job out of Scientology, which was always a little bit suspicious. God knows how the guy managed it. He was married, he had children, and he was working, doing a full-time day job, and every evening he was working in Hansi, and every weekend he was working in Hansi. I don't know how he kept going, but he did manage to keep going for a while anyway. It was also around about this time, I wouldn't like to say exactly at this time, it was also around about this time that George Wishlow quit the org as well. I don't recall seeing him around the org after this time. I think he simply had enough. He couldn't get along with Atkinson, but he didn't put his name to the, with O'Connell and Fred Welling. But he couldn't get along with the woman. And he realised that the place was going to the dogs. I think that Dennis O'Connell going, the Fred Welling going, was too much for him. That was the last straw. Anne and I had gone. Now O'Connell and Welling had gone. And there was nothing left as far as he could see. There was no point in him straining himself anymore. So he simply retired back to his magic and his conjuring and his pre-clears. And we never really saw much of George after that. But the org never really recovered. Never recovered from the blow of losing George on its public comm lines. They tried various HPA graduates to look after the PE courses and the introductory courses, but nobody could do it like George. And the inflow of the Hazy London at that point suffered a marked fall in the inflow of new numbers, for which I believe it never really recovered for many years. Didn't recover that loss of inflow of material, of new blood. Just before the blow-up that caused the quitting of O'Connell and Fred Welling, just before this, there was the most peculiar state of affairs happened, and which I suspect the outcome of this peculiar state of affairs partly led to the vanishment of Fred Welling. Why Ron so quickly accepted Fred Welling's resignation. Anyway, it started off with a telephone call, actually saying that Ron had requested that some techniques be run on me, some special auditing be done on me, free of charge, in the clinic there, and it would be done by one of Fred's staff auditors. And would I come in and discuss the matter? And it was to be done as a favour to Ron. I said, well, that's okay by me. So I came in and spoke to Fred. And I said, well, show me what you've got. What is it? What are you going to run? Why? And he explained. He said, I don't know. He said, well, I just have this authorization. I mean, he was decent enough. He showed me the authorization there. And he obviously knew no more than that. And I said, well, what techniques are you going to run? And he said, well, I can't tell you that. He said, until you actually agree to have the auditing. I said, well, that's fair enough. And I said, okay, I'll have the auditing. And then Fred said, well, he said, well, as soon as you start in the auditing, you'll soon find out what the techniques are. I said, well, that's even that's okay. I said, I'm in no hurry to find out what the techniques are. So I'd made myself available. And it was apparent it wasn't going to take more than a session or two, the whole thing. I don't know what it was. I think it might have been some form of security check. But I never did find out, as it turned out. Anyway, he introduced me to the staff auditor, and we headed off to an auditing room. And he was a decent enough young man. He was a new staff auditor. I hadn't seen him before. He had two staff auditors at that time, Fred. The other one was auditing a cash customer, and I got the newest one, and which was okay by me. I didn't mind. But I pitied this poor lad because he was a recent graduate from the course, and of course I had a tremendous altitude at that time in the, amongst the auditors in London. You know, I mean, I was an old timer, and I'd audited more hours of auditing than he'd had hot dinners, and he knew it. And so he was a bit worried that I might be critical of his auditing technique. Auditing such an old hand as me, but anyway, he did his best. There was nothing wrong with him technically. He was quite competent. He got the session started and got his meter hooked up and so on, and off we went. And so we hardly got the session started, and then walks Fred Welling, stands there. I look at Fred, and we start to do some objective processes. Fred stands there for a couple of minutes, he walks out the room. And we finished doing a little bit of objective processes, and pick up the cans, we're about to start, and the door opens, in walks Fred Welling. And I've stopped and looked at him. I said, what's going on, Fred? He said, obviously, I've got to supervise the auditing. I said, well, you can't supervise it in here, mate. I said, you'll have to supervise it outside. I said, I can't go into session with you hovering around. There he was, hovering around like a bloody avenging angel. You know, I knew what was happening. Ron had told him. He got a note from Ron saying that to keep a close eye on the auditing, you know, and he was doing just that, but it was a particularly ham-fisted way of doing it. And I said, well, look, I can't go into session with you hovering around here. So he went out. And so the guy started to rustle for the papers, and then he ran a little bit of ARC straight wire to sort of get me moving on the track. I thought, well, that's fine. We'd hardly had a couple of commands, and the door quietly opened, and I opened half an eye, and guess what? There's Fred Welling creeping back into the bloody room. I put the bloody cans down with a crash. What the bloody hell's going on, Fred? I said, look, either if you want to audit me, if you want to know what's going on in the session, you audit me. If you want this person to audit me, you'll have to go out the room. You can't both be in here while I'm being audited, and that's final. And of course, it was a code breach. I mean, if Fred had been a better technically trained, had a better grasp and understanding, he would have known that if the preclear objects to the presence of another person in the room, that the auditor has to eject the other person and to try and audit the person in the presence of an unacceptable third person is a present time problem, and you can't audit a pre-clear over a PTP. And so that's it's a code breach to even attempt it. So the whole situation was fraught with auditing flubs. If Ron had been there, he would have cried. It was so full of flubs. And so I made it quite clear. I said, but, of course, it was the auditor's job to eject Fred Welling. But Fred wouldn't. The lad obviously couldn't, because Fred was his boss. So I had no such constraints. I told him to get out. And eventually, he said he was going to stay. And I said, well, that's it. And I said, you fuck off. I said, I'll go home. I said, I'm not going to be audited with you hovering around in the bloody session. I've lost my temper. And then he lost his temper with me. He said, look, he said, I've got to supervise this, he said. And I said, well, you're going to bloody well supervise it without the pre-clear. I said, you won't be doing it with me, I said. You have no pre-clear, present. You can do your supervising on an empty bloody chair. And So he turned around to the auditor and said, one of the strangest things I've ever heard an auditing supervisor say to his staff auditor in all my years in Scientology. He turned around to the auditor, he lost his temper, he turned around to the auditor and said, give this man 15 hours on the walls. And I just couldn't believe it. It was just like Captain Bligh on the deck, on the quarter deck, saying to one of his officers, give this sailor 15 lashes. You know, the mock-up was there, absolutely complete. The sadistic naval captain. And I just collapsed into helpless laughter. It was just too much. And Fred stalked out of the room with my laughter ringing in his ears. I mean, there was nothing he could do about it. I mean, the session was obviously over. The young auditor tried to patch the session together and get us going again. I said, no way. There's no way I can do this auditing under these circumstances. And so he realised I was in quite a good case. You know, I'd been line charging. I was quite happy. So he ended the session off and started to take some responsibility by ending the session. That was the smartest thing he did. He ended the session off and I simply strolled off out the building. And I never heard any more about it. Even to this day, I don't know what Ron wanted running on me. But I do know that Fred would have had to make a report to the old man and would have had to report that Stephen's blue. And Ron would have been unkind about that, because Pre-Clears Who Blow is an auditor flub in Ron Hubbard's book, and it always was that way in Ron Hubbard's book. If the pre-clear blows, it's the auditor's responsibility. If a pre-clear blows, it's an auditor flub. So he would have had to eat a bit of crow there, he would, in front of the old man. But anyway, I never heard any more about it, so I don't know what it was to this day. And I never wrote to the old man about it. I was too furious. Too insulted about it. I don't know what Ron wanted, and I never found out. But it was just, and soon afterwards that happened, this blow-up occurred, and Fred Wernham left. And I've got a feeling he would have been pretty glad to see the last of him, Ron would. As to the Fred Wernham's meaning of give this man 15 hours on the walls, I imagine that he meant that give this pre-clear 15 hours of SOP 8C, run 15 hours of 8C on him to bring him under control. I imagine that's what he meant. But I'm only guessing. Anyway, a few days after Fred Welling left the clinic and took his staff auditors with him, I got a phone call from Gene Atkinson asking me to come in, and so I asked him to come in about a position in the clinic. So I spoke to Anne. I said, it looks as if the old man wants me back. So she says, well, you better go and find out what's going on. So I went in and spoke to Jean, and she showed me the letter from Ron, with an enclosure to me, asking me to come back in to retake over the clinic. There was no apology from him for all the bloody upset. I mean, I should never have been fired off the bloody line in the first place. Anyway, he wanted me back. And Gene said that we've got another staff auditor for you, a guy called Rex Kirby. And so the following Monday morning, I said, OK, that's agreeable to me. We might as well complete this cycle. After all, I did promise Ron I'd look after his clinic for him. So the following Monday morning found me back on post, this time as a salaried staff member. And Rex Kirby turned up, a very well-dressed young graduate from the HPA course, complete with pinstripe trousers and black jacket, looking almost the perfect psychoanalyst. But he was a very nice lad. And the only thing we lacked, of course, was pre-clears. But anyway, we did get the mock-up underway. The word seemed to somehow soon get around that there was a competent person back in the clinic there, and some pre-clears started to contact the org again. It's amazing how these things do get around. It's sheer telepathy, it is. And we did start to get some customers after about a week or so. And Rex and I were pretty well fully, well, I wouldn't say we were fully employed ever, but we did have enough to keep us to keep us amused. And we were both auditing, and I was DOPing his pre-clears for him. And he wasn't a bad auditor, Rex Herbie. And so we jogged along there. But the real difficulty was that, and no doubt Fred Welling had the same difficulty, was that our front was wrong. We were down there, we had no reg with us in the clinic, and the front was the administrator, Gene Atkinson. In other words, anyone approaching the org for auditing had to go to Gene Atkinson. And they wouldn't have been impressed. She simply did not impress as a person. You've got a very, you know, if she was the first person you met when you walked into a Scientology organisation, you would think, well, this is a pretty miserable sort of bloody place here. It's a pretty downtown scale sort of place. She didn't give an uptown scale impression, you know. She was too sort of jaded, too sort of grubby, you know. It was a grubby mock-up she actually put over, and it didn't go on the puppet line. You don't want somebody like that who's your registrar in a clinic. You've got to have somebody who's bright and smiling and alert and right on the ball, and preferably somebody who's very good with their tech. That's very important on a reg line, to have somebody who's good at tech. So that was the real cause of the trouble. But I mean, behind that caused the trouble was, what the hell was this woman doing there in the first place? Ron, evidently, it took him many, many years to realise, if he ever did realise it, that there's absolutely no future in putting an untrained personnel in charge of trained personnel. That he did it time and time again in the organisations of Scientology, in the USA and in London. He picks an untrained person and put them in charge of his highly trained technical staff, and they simply had no respect for this untrained person. I mean, this untrained person could have a thousand degrees in accountancy and business administration and what have you, but these people, the technical staff, were looking, they were only interested in technical people, you see. Actually, this is a true datum in any business, in any organisation. Your technical staff in any organisation never have any respect for the non-technical staff. It works anywhere, it does. You know, you get an organisation, see, you get a rubber company, say. I remember I worked in a rubber company once in Australia for a while, and the chemist there and his assistant, they had absolutely no respect for the administration staff in the place who was technically in charge of them, because they knew that the administration staff knew absolutely nothing about rubber. It was as simple as that. So they simply didn't respect them. It was the same in HASI. It's very difficult for technical staff, who are experts at auditing and experts at training and so forth, and experts in the technical field of Scientology, to have any respect for an administrator who's put in charge of them. It's all right if the administrator's not put in charge of them, and they're equal rank in the organisation, then they'll work with the administrator. But the mistake is to put the un-Scientology trained administrator in charge of the technical personnel. It never did work, and it took Ron made many, many mistakes upon that line there. It just caused a hell of a lot of friction in his organisations. He finally stopped doing it. But it was many years later before he finally stopped doing it. I mean, the great affinity we all had with our first administrator, Anne, was that we all knew that she was a competent Scientologist. She was a competent auditor. She was an old-timer. She'd done hundreds of hours of book auditing. She knew the subject as good as anyone did. So we respected her. And there was a respect on the line, you see. But we had no respect for Rach Gordon. Nobody had any respect for Gene Atkinson, simply because these people knew nothing of the subject they were working in. Well, the spring of 1954 was turning into the summer of 1954, and lo and behold, the news arrived that Jack Horner was about to turn up, hot from an advanced clinical course where he had been a student in the USA, and he was coming hot-footing it across to London, and he was going to give the first doctorate course in Hazy London. Ron was still away and wasn't due back, although everyone hoped to see him later on in the year, but it was still uncertain whether he would come back. But Horner was coming over, and this was the long-awaited news. We were all wonderfully excited at the idea of a doctorate course being given, and we were all hoping to be able to get on this course. The staff members, of course, would get on the course anyway. But anyway, that's jumping a little bit ahead. Anyway, Horner arrived, and guess what? Guess who he brought with him? He had a nuclear. At least he said she was clear, and but she was a beautiful girl, and of course she was sleeping with Jack Horner. But I don't know where he didn't find this girl in America, and he must have picked this one up in the British Isles, because she was a ward of an English court, and we didn't know it at the time, but she was a ward of court. I don't know. I never did get the details of how she got mixed up with Jack Horner, who she was very keen on. The girl's name was Pamela, and she arrived with Jack Horner. First day he arrived in the clinic, we saw him, he had Pamela with him. Of course, Jack and I knew each other from back in 1951 when he'd given that Congress before, so we're old pals. But he brought with him some really good news. He had a note from Ron authorising Anne to come on the clinical course. Ron wanted Anne to do the doctorate course. Ron considered that Anne had done an awful lot of good work for the organisation while she'd been on post in the early days, and he wanted to repay it by giving her a doctorate course. He knew that she was unable to do the HPA course, and because she was helping out on the lines there while the course was running. And so he was now repaying Anne. So all was forgiven. He obviously wanted to get Anne back into the organisation. That was his way of doing it. So broke the news to Anne. She was rather pleased. And Horner started to set up to get ready for the course. Well, this was a different proposition from Nibs. Horner was a highly skilled technician and a very, very competent instructor. Very incompetent. No problems at all fielding questions, technical questions, no problem at all in handling a class of students and running a course. He'd done it before. We'd seen him in action before. We knew the quality of the man. Another old timer that turned up on the course was George Wishlow. Again, that was via Ron. Ron wanted him back on the course. He obviously wanted George back on the lines again, so he'd given George a free place and his recognition of his services. So George turned up to do the course as well, which was a great addition. So it was a meeting of the old timers, and the only one who was missing was Dennis O'Connell. O'Connell never showed. So whether Ron wrote to him and offered it to him and he refused, I don't know. But Dennis O'Connell never did re-enter back on the org lines. In fact, he, as far as I know, he worked in the field for about 6 months as a field auditor after he left the organisation. And then I think he drifted out of Scientology. He went in and bought some property and started to buy out rentals and became a property speculator. I believe that was what he eventually got into. Him and Olive, they got into property speculation. He built up a series of rental flats that he owned in the semi-slum area around Bayswater somewhere. Anyway, that's, I believe, what happened to Dennis O'Connell. He never did. He was a black case, Dennis. And I unfortunately, always had him down and noted in my book to get my paws on Dennis O'Connell's case. But I never did. Never managed it. Never got round to trying my luck at breaking his blackness. I reckon I could have done it. But and maybe he knew I could, and he always kept away from me. But anyway, it was we never did meet up case wise. I never did get a chance to get my paws on his blackness. Anyway, the course got underway. George Wishlow was looking bright and healthy in a brightly coloured summer shirt. He turned up and all rearing to go again. All was seemed to be forgiven. Jack Horner was in mighty good spirits. We had a good turn up, a good lot of old timers turned up for the clinical course, and we got underway. And during the period of the course, I had more than one opportunity to see Jack Horner auditing, getting other auditors out of tricky spots that they got themselves in with their free clear. And I had a chance to realise what a good auditor he was. He was the second best auditor, second to the old man who I'd ever seen was Horner. He was good, very good. A very fine auditor was Jack Horner. Another amusing incident occurred about halfway through the doctorate course. I don't remember the lead up to it. I know that one evening, very late one evening, it was after 11, I had occasion to go back into the clinic to pick up a book from my office, and I don't know why I wasn't with Anne. I think Anne must have gone home earlier, and I must have been out talking with someone or something. But I know that the earliest point I can recall is walking along the road and walking up the stairs into the Hazzy, which was into the clinic, which of course was in complete darkness. It was 11 o'clock at night, and I had a key, of course, and let myself in, and was heading off to my office to get my book, which I wanted to read, in the bus on the way home. And suddenly I heard a sound in the front office, in the main office there. Oh Christ, we've got bloody burglars in. So I opened the door of the main office and flipped on the light, and there was another scuffle, and then I looked across the room. There was Pam hiding behind the curtain without a stitch on, and they're peering around the side of the carpet, peering around the side of the desk. There was Jack Horner, looking equally unclad, and there was a pile of cushions on the floor. And I just said sorry, and switched the light out, walked down the corridor, switched the hall light on, went in my office, picked my book up, and went back out, switching the lights out, and closed the door behind me. The following morning I turned up for class, and Jack was talking, giving an introductory talk before he put the tape on, and he looked right at me, and I looked right back at him, and there wasn't a flicker on either of the expressions on our faces, but it never was mentioned, not a word. But it was a very amusing incident. Obviously, I'd interrupted a great love scene. Most of Horner's girlfriends that we knew of had disappeared into oblivion with Horner in the past, but this one didn't disappear into oblivion. She had a great Scientological future ahead of her, did Pam. Anyway, towards the end of the course, Horner gave a congress, but just to finish off this bit with Pam, he eventually tried to get out of the country and take Pam with him. And of course, as soon as she got to the airport, there's no way in the world that she could get out of the country. She was a ward of court. It was stamped on her passport. And Horner was in trouble with immigration, and there was a bit of a fracas apparently. And he had to leave the country rather hurriedly. It got mentioned on the radio, the BBC, that this American was trying to get a ward of court out of the country without the court's permission. I'm sure Jack just didn't know. And of course, the courts in England are very, very tough on that sort of thing. You know, you try and get a ward of court out, you're in immediate trouble. And they suspected the worst. And God knows what Horner's wife was saying back in America. She no doubt heard about it, because it went all over the media in England. It got on the radio. I remember hearing it on the radio. And that's when Jack disappeared out of the country. But we never saw Jack again. He never did turn up in England with any more, at least not before Anne and I left England. He never did turn up with any more clears. Pam went on. She was very upset when Jack had to leave and she couldn't go with him. She was very upset, and but she met up her future husband, a guy named Ray Kemp, and who'd done his training in California. He had an English mother, Elizabeth Kemp, and an American father, I believe, and he'd been in the American Navy, and he'd recently got his discharge from the American Navy, and he'd done his training, his auditor training in California, and was over here in London, was going to take up residence in London, and him and Pam met up, and they simply fell in love with each other at first sight. And about a month after Horner left, whether she married him on the rebound or from Horner, I don't know, but Ray was devoted to Pam, Pam was devoted to Ray, and a few months they got married, and a few months later a child was born, and I remember Anne and I went to their flat in Golders Green. We were great friends. He was a great guy. I liked Ray Kemp and Pam. They were great people. Went to their flat, and Ray was out for the day. We don't know where he was, but we went round and had a cup of tea with Pam, and she had a baby on her knee, and in the other hand she was reading a book on contraception. And I thought that was hilariously funny. But Ray and Pam Kemp became one of the great Scientology marriages, and as far as I know, they're still together. It was a love match from the very beginning, those two. Ray was a very good promoter of Scientology. That was, again, that was his speciality. He was very good at PE work, a very good promoter, and he was a very valuable person to have around, Ray Kemp. Come the end of the course, there was the inevitable Congress, and which was fronted by Horner, but this was a far cry from the one that had been run by Nibs. This Congress was a good one. Horner was an old hand at this sort of thing, and everyone had a wonderful time. And the Congress dance we had, I told Jack that I could get a dance band down and would actually play in it, and I contacted my old dance band that I used to play for. I'd have to give it up, of course, I was too busy. And but they brought my tenor sax down, and from my home in Edgware, and although I was a bit rusty, they'd replaced me with an electric guitarist. But he didn't show up that evening. I'd gone back, it was just the three-piece rhythm section, and me on the tenor sax at the Congress dance, and everybody was quite amazed. None of them knew that I was quite an accomplished musician. And everybody was quite amazed. Even Jack Horner had a bit of a slack jaw when he heard how well I played a saxophone. So it was a very successful dance that evening, and I've got some beautiful photographs of Horner and the whole crowd and me playing the saxophone in the photo album. As we predicted, as the course ended, a note came over from the old man to Anne that he wanted her on the reg post in the clinic. That's what he had lined up for her, and he was absolutely right. Of course, that was exactly precisely the right place where she should be, and it couldn't have been any better if I'd have requested it myself. I needed someone there to look after that front office, and someone to stop this people wandering in to see Gene Atkinson. So instead of meeting Gene Atkinson, who was dowdy and so forth, they were meeting a doctor of Scientology, highly trained, right on the ball, and a very, very attractive woman. And Anne moved into that mock-up absolutely perfectly. And things went very, very well along that line there. Of course, I was still DFPing, and Anne was looking after the reg line, and we've got somebody else looking after the telephone in the front office there, and one of Gene Atkinson's minions had come up to help look after the telephone, and the mock-up, the clinic, was now going very, very well indeed. We got a good front, and clearly it was almost two separate organisations going now. There was the administration going on down at 163, and everything else seemed to be eventually was going to move up to the clinic. The HPA course was still going on down at 163, but it was obviously only a matter of time before it moved up into the clinic, because we had plenty of room for it. All in all, during this period of late 1954 through to early 1955, was quite a happy, stable period in the org. It was almost like old times. we had it was myself and Anne and Stan Richards, and the only two that were missing was George and Dennis O'Connell of the old team. But three of the five were back on the tack lines, and we were doing very, very well again. The next thing of importance that happened in early 55 was the sudden announcement by Stan Richards, that he was emigrating to Australia. And this was going to be a great loss to us all. He dumped it on us rather suddenly, Stan did. He'd married. His wife wasn't... we never saw his wife around the org, but he'd married over the years, and he wanted to emigrate to Australia. And so we lost our day instructor, and this posed a considerable problem. George Wishlow stepped in for a while. He was there for two or three months looking after the HPA course in the daytime. But it wasn't in George's heart and soul. It was never in teaching. He was never much good at it. You know, from the early days, tech was never his strong point. But he held the post down for a while. Then suddenly, out of the blue, while things were sort of going on still, Ron turned up. Ron just arrived back in this would have been around about the middle of 1955. Just before the middle, I'd say, of 1955, Ron turns up back in London. Well, long awaited and welcomed. The first thing he did, one of the first things he did, well, let me get things in sequence. The very first thing he did, he wanted some money out of the org there. Of course, Gene Atkinson had the signatory on the check account at the bank. He went to Gene and said he needed some money, would you transfer some funds out for him? It was his organisation. And Chief flatly refused. He said, what do you want the money for, Ron? He said, well, that's nothing to do with you. I never heard this altercation, but it was reported to me. He said, you just hand the, let me have the checkbook. She said, sorry, Ron. She said, no money goes out of this account without my signature. And he says, you can't do that. She said, I've done it. And she showed him the authorization. While he'd been in America, she'd bought that organization out from under him. She'd got it out from underneath him. He had no access to the funds of Hazy London, Ron, at that time, in 1955. And he was absolutely furious. Apparently, he stalked out the office, and they thought he broke the bloody door down when he went out. He was absolutely furious. And the true nature of Jean Atkinson suddenly showed itself. She was the first person that I knew of that actually stole a Hazy. And the outcome was that Ron, he took legal advice on it, but there was no way around it. It was sewn up. The only way he could get rid of it was to buy her out, and it cost him £8,000. That was the fee that she settled on. It cost him £8,000 to buy her out and get his funds back and get his Hazy back and get his hands on the funds. So he owned the bloody lot. You'll always find he was so furious, you'll find on the Johannesburg sec check, the Joburg sec check, which became into common use in Scientology in 1954-55, you'll find that strange question, have you ever stolen a Hazy? And that was put on there by Ron over the Atkinson incident. He was determined that would never occur again, that nobody would ever steal an organisation out from underneath him. So he put that on the security check, and henceforth every student, every student and everyone on the org lines had to pass that security check, and one of the questions was, have you ever stolen a Hazy? So, of course, Gene went. He bought her out, and out went Atkinson. Atkinson was replaced by Jack Parkhouse. The whole administration moved up into Jack Parkhouse, by the way, had been on the clinical course. He'd done it with Jack Horner. He'd done the clinical course with Horner. He was one of the students and shown himself a very, very capable Scientologist and a very capable auditor. His early promise had been maintained, and he took over the administration role. But again, nobody minded this at all, because he was given the post of association secretary, and he had an office in the clinic, and he was nominally in charge of the whole show, Jack was. But nobody minded this in the slightest. He was a first-class technical person, first-class auditor, and quite capable at handling any aspect of the subject. He knew the subject, so we were very, very happy to accept Jack on board. He quickly became one of the team there, and he organised the moving of the whole of the admin out of 163 Holland Park Avenue. That he moved the whole lot out there and appointed an office manager. We had an office manager there, and the empty offices down the corridor that had been empty, they were too big for auditing rooms, he utilised those as two of them as office space. And the whole administration section moved into there. And we had an office manager who worked under Jack Parkhouse. And Jack was in charge of the whole show. And he was running everything, and there was other changes at this point too. Because Stan Richards had left, George wasn't happy doing the course there, and he told Ron so. And so Ron approached me and said, "Look," he said, "I'd like Anne to go and do the DFPing on the clinic," and he said, "I want you to take over the training. I want you to not only become London's Director of Training London," he said, "but you'll also be responsible for all the examinations worldwide." He said, "I'm not far from happy about the system of examinations. It's too patchy and too scratchy," he said, "all over the world. We've got to standardise it." He said, "And the first thing I want you to do is to compose an examination paper for a theory paper for HPA students, and pass it over to me for my approval." And when we've got it squared around, he said, "Well, we'll use it henceforth all over the world." I said, "Right, Ron, it will be done." And so the HPA course moved up to Palace Gardens Terrace, moved out of 163. But now the HPA had moved out of 163 into Palace Gardens Terrace. The whole administration had moved out from 163 and was now in Palace Gardens Terrace. The only thing that left down at 163 was the PE administration, the public courses going on down there in the evening and the weekends. We held those offices. Ron still held those offices, and he wanted to use the space for lecturing himself. So he held onto the premises, even though they were a little bit underutilized for a while. Most of the activity was now at 83 Palace Gardens Terrace. This was a wonderful opportunity for me, because I was now broadening my Scientology skills. I'd become a very, very competent processing and a DFPing, and now I was now moving over to the training side, which is the other main technical aspect of Scientology. I was now going to be to learn all the intricacies of training and examinations and so forth. So I was very, very pleased with this, and I was certainly looking forward to the event. Anne was now collected herself three new staff auditors who come on the comm lines. One was a guy named Herbie Parkhouse. That was Jack Parkhouse's younger brother, who just graduated from the HPA course. And another was a girl called Jo Davis. Jo Blythe, sorry. She later became Jo Davis, and she married the third staff auditor, Bob Davis. So we had the three staff auditors there, and there's another girl staff auditor, Nan Beardsley. They were the four staff auditors. There was a few other ones who used to come and go, but that was the main ones we started with, those four that Anne started with. And Anne was now going to get stuck into the DFPing and regging. She was reg and DFP. They do mix those two posts. Those two posts do mix together. And although in later all boards, Ron separated the posts again. I think it's a mistake. The two posts are very, very intimately connected. That's what I meant when I said earlier that the registrar should be a technically trained person. And if the Reggie is a good technically trained person, they can also be the DFP. They can DFP the cases and reg them as well. Ron Jeffcott, the weekend instructor, he moved his weekend and evening class into 83 Palace Gardens Terrace, into the subsidiary room there. We had the big room that we used for main courses and clinical courses, BSCN courses and so forth. That was our big room, our big lecture room. Then we had a subsidiary, a slightly smaller lecture room, which we could use for HPA courses. And as I say, the PE courses were still taking place down at 163. Mary Sue Hubbard had arrived over with Ron, with the family, and they set up residence in... Yes, it escapes me. I went there on more than one occasion, but I've forgotten which suburb it is. It was around... it was a flat they had somewhere around, I believe it was around Bayswater Way somewhere. It wasn't all that far from Palace Gardens Terrace. It was a very nice flat they had, and I went over there on more than one occasion. We saw a lot of Ron during this period, and socially. It was quite common for Ron and Jack Parkhouse and Anne and I to go out after in the evening and have a meal. And so forth. He was really socialising, much more than he'd ever socialised with us back in the early days, in 1952, late 52, early 53. He was socialising much more with us. And it was quite I remember on more than one occasion, we even went out to took Jack Parkhouse and I out to a nightclub where we sat and drank whiskey till about 2 o'clock in the morning. So our sociable, our executive director was getting. But the org was going well. One had to hand it to Jack. Jack was good. He was a very fine administrator, and he was using his technical knowledge of Scientology in his administration. And we all respected Jack, and the team worked. It worked. Ron knew it was working. And that was why he was so pleased with it. It was a good choice. It was one of Ron's good choices, that was, when he chose Jack Parkhouse. I mean, that lad had come in on the HPA course and he shone right from the word go. And then he'd pushed on and then paid for the clinical course himself, done the clinical course under Horner, and again shone as an auditor, graduated. And Horner had no doubt recommended him, because he was good. And Ron said, right, I need somebody to look after the place. And he made no mistake this time. He didn't choose an untrained person. He chose Jack Parkhouse, and he did it right. I quickly became introduced to the intricacies of instructing, of giving impromptu lectures. I was a little bit, at first, you know, a little bit of trepidation there. So I'd never done it before, but it soon wore off. I soon became within a few weeks I was very, very accomplished at giving spontaneous talks and so forth. And my lectures on the axioms, which I used to give to the class, became a standard part of all the HPA. I used to make a point eventually of visiting the weekend course and the evening course, and I used to give them all little talks on the axioms, and they were all very, very much appreciated. And things were going, things went very well, and I was quickly got into the training mode, got out of the DFP mode and got into the DFT mode. Meanwhile, Anne was building up a considerable team there of staff auditors who were getting very, very loyal to Anne. This caused a lot of trouble in the future, their loyalty to their region DFP. But that you could understand it. I mean, they had a tremendous respect for Anne because of her natural ability as an auditor. They'd seen her work, and they knew what she could do. And they were all recent graduates from the course, and they simply looked up with awe and admiration at this old timer and the way this old timer could handle a pre-clear, and the sheer breadth of her understanding of auditing difficulties and how she could solve these difficulties and help them to solve their pre-clear difficulties. And so they, you know, marvellous. Then Ron used to come along in the evenings at times. He used to come in and DFP, the staff auditors, and we all used to get in on the act because it was a rare pleasure to have Ron DFPing. He called the staff auditors in, and Anne and I would be there, and Jack Parker asked if he was available. If he wasn't too busy, he used to drop in too. And for an hour, Ron would talk to the staff auditors, and we'd get an impromptu lecture. And it was all very, very, all very, very good. And so Ron was taking a very, very personal interest in Hazy London at this point. It was beginning to look good. It was a part of the golden years, that 1955 was a part of the golden years of Hazy London there. Everything was swinging along. Almost needless to say that once the organisation, once Ron was there and the organisation was swinging along, the pre-clear started to come in and the PE lines looked up and the books started to sell. It was quite amazing, and we had no shortage of people coming in, and Anne had enough pre-clears going to keep her four staff auditors permanently amused. In fact, at one time she had as many as six staff auditors going, her four regular ones and two spares that she had. And we were, you know, beginning to look towards where the hell we're going to find some more auditing rooms, because we only had four regular auditing rooms. So four main staff auditors. The one who probably became most well known in Scientology was Herbie Parkhouse. He, in the later years, he became became one of the instructors on the St Hill briefing course, and became quite a well known Scientologist, Herbie. Bob Davis and Joe Davis eventually emigrated to Australia, and we saw them in Australia, because Anne and I went to Australia, and we met up with them in Australia. Well, they met up with us. They emigrated after we did, but eventually we saw them in Australia. Nan Beardsley, she eventually married an American Scientologist, an American auditor, and went and lived in Hawaii. And we're still in touch with Nan Beardsley, in present time. He's just died, her husband has, the American auditor. But she's still going. She's still alive, Nan Beardsley. Well, this time a very amusing incident occurred. We used to have Anne used to run a service for the public, what was called the two-hour assist. It was run in the evening. One of the staff auditors was assigned. And the idea was that people could ring in during the day, and if they needed a quick assist, or they've got some little problem or other, and they could come in as long as they came in before 6:30 at night, and registered before 6:30 at night, they could get the assist done that evening. And but they had to be there by 6:30, because after that the auditor would go home, and Anne would go home. There'd be nobody there, and they couldn't do it. So, but one evening, about 7:15, we just finished. Ron, I believe, had been DFPing, and we'd all just strolled out of Ron's office. And the receptionist says that there's a guy turned up for a two-hour assist, and so Anne registered him. And she said, "We just missed me staff auditor's gone. The other, she'd scheduled one of them, and he'd gone off down the stairs. She'd missed him. He was quite right. It was well after 6:30. He'd gone home. I think it was Herbie. If one of them. He'd gone anyway, and she'd missed him. So she looked at me. She said, "Will you handle it?" I said, "Sure." And, a few minutes later, I trotted an elderly Jewish chappie down to the auditing room, and got him into session, found out what the problem was. He was in a terrible state. He was in grief stricken, and it turned out to be one of the more interesting auditing sessions I've ever given in my life. I thought, "Oh well, this is fine." And he found out that his best friend had died that day, and that morning he'd heard the sad news, his best friend, and he'd been grief stricken ever since. And so I just ran this out as an ordinary loss engram. I was running it, and he kept crying and crying and crying, and I thought myself, "We're not getting anywhere on this one, Dennis. We're not getting anywhere. We're not getting anywhere. We're not getting to the heart of this." And so I questioned him again. How long had he known this man? Oh, he'd known him for years and years and years. And off he went into tears again. And what was their association? And, oh, well, he was, they were in business together. And, oh, yeah. And what sort of business? Oh, well, he said, I'm in the diamond market. Oh, yeah. And this other chappie who died? Is he in the diamond market? Oh, yes, yes, he's a diamond trader. And we've been in the market together for years and years and years. And he burst into tears again. And I could see by my meter reactions I was getting warm. And I said, well, what is it about these diamonds? Well, he said, it's awful, he said. I don't know what I'm going to do. I said, what do you mean, what are you going to do? He says, well, he said, I've been selling him diamonds all these years, he says, and making a little, you know, profit on the diamonds, he says, and now I won't be able to do it anymore. Well, I said, well, why won't you be able to sell the diamonds to someone else? Oh, no, he said, nobody else would be able to give me that price that he would give me. And suddenly the penny dropped. What this guy was crying over, what was upsetting him, was loss of profit. You wouldn't believe it. I thought the guy was running a loss of affinity, or he'd lost a friend, you know. No, he was a Jew. It was loss of future profit. That was what was knocking him down his own scale. He'd been absolutely... You know, for years he'd been flogging these bloody diamonds to this other bloke and making a profit out of him and exploiting the other guy's lack of knowledge of the trade, no doubt, making a huge profit out of it. And now suddenly this other guy had died and he all his profit was now gone, and it knocked him into grief. Anyway, once we got to the core of it, his tears rapidly packed up and he said, I don't know what I'm going to do. I said, well, you'll just have to go and find someone else to sell the diamonds to, won't you? And he said, I suppose I will. And he said, thank you very much. How you feel about it now? He said, well, you have helped me. And he went off very happily and saw Anne, and we finished the session off and so forth. Well, I finished the session off and he went off home. And everyone was quite happy about it. No, Anne wasn't there. No, that's right. He didn't see Anne. I saw Anne when I got home. Anne had left. She didn't stay. And I reported the whole thing to her. She thought it was hilarious. She said, thank God you handled that one, Dennis, she said. She said, not one of my staff auditors could have handled that. They'd have made a bloody dog's breakfast out of that one, she said. They would never have spotted it in a million years. You need an old hand to pick that one apart, to figure out why this guy was crying. Loss of profit. What next? Well, things jogged along towards September. Summer was passing, it got into autumn, and Ron decided to run another clinical course. This time he was going to run it at 163 Holland Park Avenue. The premises had been changed somewhat down there. He'd got permission to do a bit of to knock a wall down, because the front office and the little office had been combined to one big area, which I hadn't been down there for a long while. I was amazed at what had taken place. I don't know how the hell they got permission to do that from the owner, but the owner had given the permission, because there the work was done. There was a nice little stage set up there, and which took up most or a good half of the little room, the stage, and the main auditorium, which had been the main front office. The whole thing was a pretty darn big room now, and it was quite big enough to run a course in. And they had a proper nice little stage there and everything, with lights and room for a microphone. And, obviously some money had been invested just by the old man for his clinical course. And fortunately, Ron had given us plenty of notice, our staff members on this one, and Anne and I were determined to get on this course, because it was a rare treat to be personally lectured by the old man, and we were absolutely determined, if humanly possible, to get on the course. I mean, obviously we were welcome on the course. It was just a question that we had to do our jobs while we were on the course. So I promptly stopped scheduling stopped scheduling students on the day course. timed it so that when the course was on, that there wouldn't be anybody on the day course. It was easily done as far as I was concerned. I just put them off for a later start. That left me free. Anne had a little more difficulty, but she managed it too. But she had to turn up at various times to do her DFP work. She couldn't drop the whole thing as easily as I could. So, but the course got underway. It was an excellent turnout there. And all that was missing, I was hoping that Dennis O'Connell would turn up for the course, but he never did. I'm sure he could have got the course if he'd have wanted it. He only had to turn up and speak to Ron. And they'd left under, broken the comm line under unpleasant circumstances. And I'm sure Ron had offered the olive branch, and Dennis had turned it down. That was the only sad thing was missing was Dennis O'Connell. George was back on the line again. He turned up to retread his doctorate. By this time, of course, we'd all got our doctorate degrees. Jack Horner had graduated us, and the certificates had all been made out, and all our doctorates had been made out and signed by Ron. And he'd even thrown in a Bachelor of Scientology degree. So I had an HPA degree and a Bachelor of Scientology degree and a Doctor of Scientology degree. And there was an HGA degree that I'd also collected along the line in the early days of, because when I did the HPA course, there was some course stipulations. You had to send in three case histories. And I was one of the few that did it. I sent in my three case histories, and that made me a graduate. So I'd got the HGA certificate as well. So I ended up with four certificates: HPA, HGA, BSCN, and DSCN. Anne had the three certificates. She never did get an HPA certificate. She had her BSCN and her DSCN. And but we were all very, very happy. We were all very well certificated. We were. The course, the clinical course, was an absolute joy, and it was one where Ron introduced the Waterloo Station processes, the not-know processes, and it was of going out spotting people and asking. Well, I'll give you, there was an interesting point there. There was some difficulty with the command. Ron was using, "What don't you know about this person?" And I wrote a comm to him. I said that I'd tried it on a pre-clear. I said, a better auditing command would be, "What wouldn't you mind not knowing?" I said I'd tested that out and found it ran better than "What don't you know?" And Ron acknowledged back, said, "Thank you very much, Dennis. I think you're right." And the following day on the course, he gave the alternate command. He wanted to test it. And all the auditors came back and said, "Yes, this command works much better." So he said, "Well, we have Dennis Stevens to thank for that." He acknowledged acknowledged where he got it from. And so it made me feel rather good. So one of the things of my contributions to Scientology was to the command for the Waterloo Station process, the not-know process. The thing we'd added to the line, of course, was our indoctrination. Of course, when Ron had come on the line there, he introduced the indoctrination course, the TRs, the training routines. One of the greatest additions to training that we'd, well, it was just revolutionized training. The first four TRs is 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and we had an indoctrination instructor, Rosina Mann, who I hired, and she was a recent HPA graduate, and I thoroughly got her to understand what was expected. And the students, when they came on the HPA course, would first of all do a week of indoctrination, to do their TRs. And it worked out absolutely marvellously. An interesting sidelight on it, that TR1 there is now known in Scientology almost universally as Dear Alice. TR1 can tell you where the Alice in Wonderland came from, with TR1. that I wandered in there on into the dock room one day to see how the course was going, and there they all were sitting reading, trying to do TR1, originate communications, reading out of a newspaper. And it didn't sound a bit right to me, reading the stock market reports and economic forecasts and so forth. It didn't sound a bit right to me, so I thought to myself, my God, they need something better than that to communicate. They need something uptone. Now, what's the most uptone book I know? Alice in Wonderland. So I went down to the local bookshop and nosed around. You've got some cheap copies of Alice? Sure, sir. I bought half a dozen copies on the spot, reclaimed the money out of petty cash, and dumped them on Rosina's desk. I said, for God's sake, stop using those newspapers. Use the Alice in Wonderland. Use the words, delete the he saids and she saids, and just use the phrases from Alice in Wonderland. There's some beautiful phrases in that book. And it took on like wildfire, Alice. The students perked up immediately. They loved Alice. And they really would communicate those beautiful phrases from Alice in Wonderland. Off with his head, you know. Beautiful, beautiful uptone phrases from Alice. And that was my own contribution to TR1, was the Alice in Wonderland. The training routine eventually became known as Dear Alice. Meanwhile, I'd finally got my examination paper out and composed a decent theory exam paper and passed it over to the old man, and he said it's fine, it's an excellent one, he thought. So we got that off to the printers, and that was in standard use. And all over it went out to the various parts of America. It went to all the American orgs that were teaching HPA. And it was used for, as far as I know, it was used for quite a while, that HPA theory paper that I prepared. And Ron was getting to rely upon me. He used to call me his encyclopedia of Scientology. He realised that I did have an encyclopedic knowledge of the subject, and he used to rely upon it. But already the seeds of the end of the line were coming, because the more that ANN staff auditors became loyal to ANN, the more it was upsetting Ron. And Ron could see that these auditors were absolutely devoted to ANN, their DFP, and it was upsetting the old man. It shouldn't have done, but it did. And the inevitable occurred one day. He simply fired ANN. And on some excuse or other, and I realised, well, this is going to be the end. We won't take it anymore. We won't take this, Anne, and I will not take this anymore. So I quit with Anne. I quit the org with Anne on the spot, and told Jack Parkhouse that this is the end. We've had enough, and he'll have to find himself some more tech staff. And we went back to Battersea. And then went back to our private practice, and so we were back off the lines again. It was an absolutely ridiculous thing for Ron to do. It was uncalled for. It was just sheer paranoia again. He had this feeling that these staff auditors were more loyal to ANN, their DFP, than they were to him, which was ridiculous. The staff auditors adored Ron. He was a god to them. But just because they used to trail around after ANN and show so much affinity to ANN, that they used to feel that Ron felt that ANN was stealing their loyalty from him. And it was the old paranoia that he had in his system, the old canker in his guts that was eating at him, that eventually caused him to destroy his own subject. So he tossed out again. He lost a brilliant DFP and a brilliant reg when he tossed ANN out. And of course I went. And he lost another brilliant technical person when he lost me. He lost a brilliant DFT examiner and also a very, very competent DFP and auditor. He lost hands down, you see. There's no way you can win with paranoia. It's a situation where the subject who's got the paranoia always loses. This happened early in 1956. About March or April, I think it blew up. We walked out and got fired. And I went in. We did some auditing and decided to emigrate to Australia. And we carried on with our auditing practice. And then I went and spoke to Jack Parkhouse, and he was quite amenable. He got Ron's permission for me to have the rights to train in Australia to teach HPA courses when we got to Australia. Ron, the ARC break was no, he had no ARC break with me. He was disappointed that I'd left, but he understood why I left, because Anne was my wife. And I couldn't stay on in the org under those circumstances when my wife had been fired, in my eyes, quite unnecessarily. After all, Leanne and I started collecting our things together, applied for emigration to Australia, and after a leisurely clearing up and getting everything, our things in order, we set off in May 1957 to see what Australia had to offer for us and the family and the children.